Samuel chapter 20. Remember that events come and go, but the Torah remains. So David fled from Naoth in Ramah. He came to Jonathan and he said, "What have I done? What is my crime and my guilt against your father that he seeks my life?" Now, we know what David's crime and guilt is against his father that he seeks his life. His crime and guilt is that he is plotting to take over the kingship. At least if you read between the lines, he's plotting to take over the kingship, although he doesn't say so explicitly. But at least that's Saul's perception. And David is not foolish enough not to realize that Saul thinks that, right? Remember that, as we pointed out last time, he's already been ordained king, or anointed king, rather. So there's a little bit of sympathy mongering here. Like, Jonathan, I haven't done anything. Why is your father trying to kill me? And also, he wants Jonathan, obviously, to help him and protect him. And this is the Haftarah, by the way, that you read before Rosh Chodesh, Machar Chodesh. And today is Rosh Chodesh. That's why we're reading it today. It was years ago I planned this. It's almost like posting months in advance, exactly, on Facebook. It's the same. David fled from Naoth in Ramah. He came to, what have I done? He replied, "Heaven forbid, you shall not die. My father doesn't do anything great or small without disclosing it to me. Why should my father, bless you, conceal this matter from me? It cannot be." So it's not clear if Jonathan is saying that Saul hasn't told him that he intends to kill David, but at least he thinks operationally he'll be in on all the details, so he will know and be able to disclose to David what's going on. David swore further, "Your father knows well that you are fond of me and has decided Jonathan must not learn of this or he will be grieved." So David's saying, the reason that your father hasn't told you is because he knows you like me. So he doesn't want to tell you because he knows you'll be upset. "But as the Lord lives and as you live, there's only a step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want, I will do it for you." So the conversation is, if you look carefully, it's a gradual leading of David's to David leading Jonathan gradually to the conclusions that he wants, which is, first of all, that, yes, I understand your father would normally tell you, but he knows that you're fond of me, and therefore I'm really very close to dying. There's but a step, which is going to arouse Jonathan's sympathy, obviously. When someone stands in front of you who says, only you can save me, you got to be pretty callous to say, I'm sorry. So then they concoct the following scheme, or better, David does, or rather, David already has this scheme in mind and just has to figure out the right time to say it. David said to Jonathan, "Tomorrow's the new moon, and I'm to sit with the king at the meal. Instead, let me go, and I'll hide in the countryside until the third evening. If your father notes my absence, you say, David asked my permission to run down to his hometown, Bethlehem, for the whole family has its annual sacrifice there." It's basically the new moon and Thanksgiving, all in one. He's going home for Thanksgiving. "If he says good, your servant is safe." If he doesn't mind that David's not there, but he thinks that he intends to kill him, so he wants him present. "If his anger flares up, know that he's resolved to do me harm. Deal faithfully with your servants, as you've taken your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you." Now, I don't remember any covenant of the Lord that Jonathan and David took, although he says, "Whatever you want, I'll do it for you." But David is upping the ante on trying to ensure. Now, in all fairness to David, he's also trying to make sure that he doesn't get killed by the king. So it's not like what he's doing, it's not like he's trying to swindle Jonathan out of money. He's manipulating him in part, but he's manipulating him so that Jonathan can help save his life. "If I'm guilty, kill me yourself, but don't make me go back to your father." Jonathan replied, "Don't talk like that. If I learn that my father's resolved to kill you, I'll surely tell you about it. David said to Jonathan, who'll tell me if your father answers you harshly? How will I know? In other words, if he flares up. And Jonathan said to David, let us go into the open. And they both went out into the open. Now, that's an interesting phrase. It might be that Jonathan thought maybe people are listening and he wants to go out into the open. I mean, he's going to show him an area in the open. Part of it is to just let him know where it is. But I also may be, you know, everywhere there are spies. Then Jonathan said to David, by the Lord God of Israel, I will sound out my father at this time tomorrow on the third day. And if his response is favorable for David, I will send a message to you at once and disclose it to you. But if my father intends to do you harm, may the Lord do thus to Jonathan and more if I don't disclose it to you and send you off to escape unharmed. That, by the way, that's the typical biblical way of saying, may God punish me. But you don't want to say, may God punish me, because words have effects. So you just say, may God do thus and more to me. So that's what Jonathan is saying, exactly the way everybody would swear, you know, may God strike me down if I don't do X, Y, and Z. May the Lord be with you as he used to be with my father. That's a sad line. Nor shall you fail to show me the Lord's faithfulness while I'm alive, nor when I am dead shall you ever discontinue your faithfulness to my house. And you'll see that this promise has consequences later on. Not even after the Lord has wiped out every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. In other words, what is Jonathan really saying? Jonathan is really saying, it seems, I know that you're going to get rid of the house of Saul. I know that. Because if you're going to be king, you can't leave the Saul guys around. That's the way it works in most of the world, you know? I mean, it's almost wired in our DNA. Like, the vitriol that you hear from the two political parties, it's almost as if one survives, the other can't. So you've got to obliterate the other party in order to rule. And in the ancient world, that was quite true. You know, it's why Richard did or didn't kill the twins in the tower. It's why you always want to get rid of the descendants of the other dynasty, because they have a tendency to grow up. And remember, in the ancient world, you didn't have to wait that long. 13, 14, 15, you were ready to be a king, so you had to kill them when they were kids. And a lot of kids got killed along the way. Caesar and Cleopatra had a child. Would have been an interesting kid, don't you think? But he was killed in youth because he was going to grow up to be the heir apparent. So Jonathan says, look, I know you're going to kill, but be kind to my descendants. And you'll see David sort of is. Thus has Jonathan covenanted with the house of David, and may the Lord requite the enemies of David. In other words, may they all be punished. And once again, Jonathan, out of his love of David, adjured him again, for he loved him as himself. It's just striking. If it happened once, it wouldn't be striking, but it is striking that repeatedly it doesn't say that David loved Jonathan. It just says that Jonathan loved David over and over. Right? And as I pointed out before, even in the eulogy, when Jonathan dies and David says, your love was sweeter to me than the love of women. Your love. Who knows? Maybe David, we can speculate about his character later, but all we can say is David's love is not mentioned here, only Jonathan's. Jonathan said to him, tomorrow will be the new moon. You can understand why this is read on the new moon. And you will be missed when your seat remains vacant. So the day after tomorrow, go down all the way to the place where you hid the other time and stay close to the Ezel stone, which was some landmark, obviously, that everyone knew. Now I will shoot 3 arrows to one side of it as though I were shooting at a mark, and I will order the boy to go and find the arrows. If I call to the boy, hey, the arrows are on this side of you, be reassured and come, for you're safe. There's no danger, as the Lord lives. But if instead I call to the lad, hey, the arrows are beyond you, then leave, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the promise we made to each other, may the Lord be witness between you and me forever. Remember, the promise that he makes to Jonathan is that he will be kind to him and to his descendants. The promise, obviously, that Jonathan makes to David is that he'll protect him from his father. David hid in the field. The new moon came, and the king sat down to partake of the meal. When the king took his usual place on the seat by the wall, Jonathan rose, and Abner sat down at Saul's side. Abner is Saul's head of his troops, chief of the army, just like Joab is for David. So if you think that they're both going to survive, you don't know the ancient world. That day, however, Saul said nothing. It's accidental, he thought. He must be unclean and not yet cleansed. He hasn't gone to the mikveh, whatever. But on that day after the new moon, the second day, David's place was vacant again. So Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why didn't the son of Jesse come to the meal yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered Saul, "David begged leave to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Please let me go, for we're going to have a family feast in our town, and my brother summoned me to it. Do me a favor, let me slip away to see my kinsmen. That's why he has not come to the king's table.'" Saul flew into a rage against Jonathan. "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." You all have judgments, but did you know his mother? Maybe she was perverse and it's just amazing. "Look what your kid has done," he shouted. "I know that you side with the son of Jesse to your shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness." In other words, the shame of the person who gave birth to you. Which is, by the way, a way of sort of disclaiming his paternity of Jonathan. Not literally, not saying I'm not really your father, but blaming it on, I disown you. It's your mother's shame that you still walk around. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingship will be secure." Now, he's right about that, actually. He's not wrong. Not so much that Jonathan won't be secure, but his kingship won't be secure. But we actually know that David has promised Jonathan that he will take care of him, and that Jonathan has already decided that Saul's not going to be king anymore, that God's not with him, that God is with David. So he's already chosen sides, and Saul knows that. "For as long as the, now then, have him brought to me, for he is marked for death." But Jonathan spoke up and said to his father, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" At that, Saul threw his spear at him to strike him down. And Jonathan realized that his father was determined to do away with David. Jonathan rose from the table in a rage. He ate no food on the second day of the new moon, because he was grieved about David and because his father had humiliated him. Now, remember, it's just worth keeping in mind, this is the Torah. And in one way or another, we're supposed to see God's hand behind all this. But the way that it's written is a completely understandable human drama, completely understandable. And it is clearly written by somebody who is sympathetic to David's plight and future. we'll be able to talk much more about that when we get to the end and we see the whole picture of David. But in the morning, Jonathan went out into the open for a meeting with David, accompanied by a young boy. He said to the boy, "Run ahead to find the arrows that I shoot." And as the boy ran, he shot the arrows past him. When the boy came to the place where the arrow shot by Jonathan had fallen, Jonathan called out to the boy, "Hey, the arrows are beyond you." And Jonathan called after the boy, quick, hurry up, don't stop." So Jonathan's boy gathered the arrows and came back to his master. The boy suspected nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the arrangement. Jonathan handed the gear to his boy and told him, "Take these back to town." When the boy got back there, David emerged from his concealment at the Negev. He flung himself face down on the ground and bowed low 3 times. They kissed each other and wept together. David wept the longer. So this too is an interesting, it's interesting to think about what they're crying about too, and why it says specifically that David wept the longer, although he deal is the greater. so greater or longer. And it might, a part of it might be that this is, up until this moment, it might be that David had cherished some hope that Saul won't kill him. Because remember, if Jonathan had given him a different outcome, he was ready to come back to Saul's palace. But now he realizes that there is, and even though we may portray David as manipulative, he's still, don't forget, he's probably, what, a 17-year-old, 18-year-old boy. So it's not as though he doesn't have a lot of conflicting emotions inside him. And Saul has been a sort of substitute father. And David, like anyone else, right, doesn't want to be hated, feared, and hunted down, especially not by the king. And now he's also losing Jonathan. Because even though Jonathan protects him, he can't now see him again. He can't get close to him again because Saul's there. So it's a pretty terrifying time. Yeah, it's awful for Jonathan, but it's worse for David. And he's got to, and you'll see, well, what Jonathan says to him. Jonathan said to David, go in peace. By the way, that's I'll come to that in a second. For we two have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord. May the Lord be witness between you and me and between your offspring and mine forever. So he says that to David, and you'll see in a moment that David now feels as though, and here's the interesting thing. Okay, so David feels as though, and we'll talk about this next time too. Is next week Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you'll forget that I said this when I say it again in 2 weeks, because I'm sure I'll repeat it. So David now has nowhere in Israel that's safe. Where can he go that the king can't find him? And so what David does is basically he goes to the Philistines, he goes to the enemy, and has to pretend, if he's pretending, and this is an interesting question, he has to pretend that he's aligned with them in order to have a place where he can go and stay and be safe. What is interesting about that is that again, I've been reading all this stuff. I even read, it's so interesting, I even read there's one biblical scholar who wrote maybe the most interesting book. His name is Baruch Halpern, on David. And he has a chapter, the title of which, this will tell you what he thinks of David. The title of the chapter is David Serial Killer. The book is full of actually some funny lines, and he's a little bit kidding, but he's a serious scholar, and he argues actually that everything, all these deaths that take place are in fact David's responsibility, except he doesn't believe the story, the worst one of all, which is the story of David, Bathsheba, and Uriah. He thinks that's the one story that actually isn't true, for reasons that we'll come to when we get to it. But he says there are two possibilities here. One possibility is that David had to go to the Philistines or to the enemy in order to escape from Saul because Saul was after him. Or he said, given the fact that it was such a fragmented country, and in fact, so many hiding places, and it's not like, I mean, you have an intelligence network, but it's very fragmentary. It's basically people who are walking around, you know, the nation and so on. He said it's as likely that David was building a power base among the Philistines, and later on, people had to give a reason why that was so, and so they said, well, because he was fleeing from Saul, he didn't have a choice. And again, it is the double-sided view of, it depends how you think of David, because eventually, of course, he's going to have to kill the Philistines, right? That's going to be his, by the way, you know where the Philistines were? In Gaza. That was where they were a seafaring people and they lived by the coast. So when you look at Gaza now, that was the stronghold of the Philistines. But either way, what's going on here is a fairly honest portrayal of what happens in a transfer of power between one king and another, and between one dynasty, one house, and the other house. Because the house of Saul was presumed to be the kingship, but now it's going to be the house of David. And the house of Saul is basically cut out forever and ever. None of his descendants, and you'll see that a bunch of them meet mysterious ends, but none of Saul's house will succeed him or ever did, and that's it, and that's the end. So then you have to ask yourself again the question, so why did God pick him in the first place? And if you're not allowed to say, well, God makes mistakes, which does seem to be, I mean, if you didn't know anything about God except from the book, you would have to say, well, God just made a mistake, then presumably in some way it is necessary for the Israelites to see an unsuccessful king and to experience an unsuccessful king before they have David, even though David and Solomon themselves are only successful for a brief while. And then, as I said, the kingdom splits apart. Anyway, okay, so let's stop for a minute at the end of 20. Any questions or comments about this chapter?
Can you go back a little bit? Can you use the word, the Lord is a witness between me and you and between the offspring?
Why don't you give me a verse? Okay.
Go in peace, for the two of us have been sworn in the name of the Lord, saying the Lord is witness between me and you, and between my seed and your seed, as the altar says.
Right, same thing though.
You think?
Yeah, seed is offspring. That's what seed means.
We would call seed, in our lingo, it's pre-offspring. It's the planting of the offspring.
No, but my seed means, it doesn't mean between my semen and your semen. It means between my kids and your kids. No, it's definitely offspring,
okay.
Right?
I'll cut it out of the book.
What's that?
I'll take it out of the book.
No, I mean, in fact, one second, I'll tell you what it's probably Zera in Hebrew. Let's see, it's 42?
Yeah,
Zari and Zarecha. So for example, in rabbinic literature, it says, Af Zaro b'chayim, who b'chayim af... which means if his seed is alive, he too is alive. Zerah, same thing. It means if your kids are alive, you're alive too. So, yeah.
So, shouldn't Jonathan be afraid for his own life at this point? And shouldn't David care about the fact that Jonathan's got to go back and face his father, knowing that he's basically seen as a traitor?
You would think, and it's interesting that it doesn't seem as though the attempt on Jonathan's life is all that serious, because if you look at what happens right after, it says that he tries to, Saul threw to strike him down. Jonathan realized his father was determined to do away with David. It doesn't say he realized his father was determined to do away with him. So, because apparently, I'm guessing, I don't know, it seems like a sort of half-hearted, you know, he just chucked his spear in his direction. Which fathers do, you know. I can't count the number of times my father would just, you know, throw a spear at us when he was ticked off about something or other. But I'm assuming because he gets up and he's angry, and it says he's grieved about David and his father had humiliated him, it doesn't say that his father tried to kill him. So I'm guessing that that's not really his fear. In fact, Saul's comment to him is, don't you realize that David is going to take away your kingship? So if he's not around, you know, David, Saul can't, that's my guess. So, yeah.
A couple of weeks ago you said that there is no indication this is a homosexual relationship.
No, I didn't say there's no indication.
You don't think that it was?
I don't think it was, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But here there's so many things, they kiss, they wept.
Right.
That so many in the gay and lesbian community point to. So
right.
Another explanation is for the words that are used.
Well, because that's what men did for most of history. As I said before, you read, for example, the Lincoln story and how he used to always sleep in bed with whoever, in a one-room shack with his law partner, and it wasn't thought of as unusual because he wasn't the only one who did it. And even now people use that as an indication that Lincoln was gay, but in the friendship of the time, was very common. And if you read the letters, even a couple hundred years ago, that men would send to each other, They're full of the most effusive, they're love letters. And nobody thought of that as being unusual or wrong or and in the ancient world too. I mean, the male friendship, the tone of male friendship changed when homosexuality becomes a category, then the words that men can use to each other become changed. But as long as homosexuality isn't thought of as a separate category, so you can speak to men the same way you speak to women, right? And if you think of the way women speak to each other and are friends with each other without somebody saying, oh, that's a lesbian relationship, then you get the same idea with men, except that not anymore, which is too bad in a way. And the reason that I suspect that it's not is just the taboo existed in biblical times, so the portrayal is unlikely to have been the biblical author is unlikely to have thought this is going to be seen as homosexual and still write it that way. I don't have a strong investment in this. If you want to make a case that it is, that's okay with me. I don't think that it's impossible that it wasn't. I just think it's likelier that it wasn't, but it could have been. Home, cooking for the feast,
now, right? Can you say that yeah. David wept more?
Right.
Could it be because he wept for his wife? Or?
That's a nice interpretation. But David. First of all, David's got a. He along the way he picks up a number of wives. And also, it is true that Michal saves his life, but the only real dialogue between Michal and David is not endearing. When he comes back with the ark later on and she's upset that he danced in front of Israel because she thinks that it exposed him and made him look foolish, and he gets upset at her, and it's then says that she never had a child. So there was a clear estrangement there. I suppose that is possible, but you don't get much of a portrayal from David, at least, that women played the same role in his life that men do. I mean, most of the story about David, although the one exception is Bathsheba, because Bathsheba, not only does he kill her husband and have two children at least with her, one or two, depending on, again, but we'll get to that when we get to that. But it's Bathsheba whose child becomes the king. So, but his wife now, Michal, does not seem to be, I would say, probably isn't the love of his life. Yeah.
There's so much the element that the first time doesn't work, the second time works. I mean, Michal doesn't work, Bathsheba works.
Well, don't forget there's Abigail in there too.
I mean, all this, yeah.
Well, I mean I didn't know you were going there, although that's a nice place to go. I was going to say that often the first attempt doesn't work and the second one does. Although there are sometimes when the second doesn't either, because God destroys the world. The second creation is God destroys the world with Noah, but the second creation doesn't work very well either. But there is certainly in the Torah this sense. I mean, we're coming up on Hanukkah. Hanukkah is, you don't know, I'm guessing that nobody here knows when the temple was dedicated, but we all know when it was rededicated. Hanukkah is the rededication, right? It's weird that there's no holiday to celebrate the dedication of the temple, but there's a holiday to celebrate the rededication of the temple. So there is something about, yes, that the second attempt or the second, third, fourth attempt is the essence of life as opposed to the first attempt. And if you want to transfer that to this world and the world to come, that's a beautiful way to think about it. There is a comment, it's funny, there in Pirkei Avot, in rabbinic literature, there are these two comments that are right next to each other. One says, this world is like a hallway to the palace of the world to come. In other words, this world doesn't really matter. What matters is the world to come. But then, right after that, it says, 1 hour of repentance and good deeds in this world is worth more than all of the world to come. So, directly contradictory one to the other, and I suppose that's because that's how we are. Sometimes we think, you know, this world is everything, and sometimes it seems like this world is really nothing. So, but it's a nice idea. Yeah.
Given the importance of women, and particularly mothers in society, I don't recall anything about David's mother or the influence.
Nope. It says absolutely nothing. We know nothing about her.
Wow.
Nothing about David's mother. No. And it's not, I mean, it's not that unusual. We don't really know much about the mothers of most of the biblical, major biblical characters. I mean, we know about Abraham's father, but we don't know about Abraham's mother. We know a tiny bit about Moses' mother, but only a tiny bit. And the Midrash fills it out, but the Torah doesn't. That's because women didn't operate in the public sphere by and large. And when we learn about the women in David's life, it's because they're operating in one way or another in the public sphere. It's not because we're getting a sudden domestic shot of how they raise their children. It's because Abigail's husband, Nabal, suddenly drops dead to David's convenience. Because Michal is Saul's daughter and saves his life, because Bathsheba is, you know, implicated in his sin and then in the birth of Solomon. But other than that, we don't really see it. So, I don't know. But if you're novelistically inclined, you could probably do a good novel on David's mother. So, there's a subject for you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just a way of swearing. It's just a way of saying, I swear to God. It's very similar to that, right? So people swear by God. And they swear, as I said, they won't swear in explicit language because then you have to say bad things and words have consequences. So. Yeah.
Talking about the women in David's life, Michal is political, Abigail is political, Bathsheba is not.
Oh, she's the end of the book. She's very political. She maneuvers to get her son to be king.
But when he first falls for her...
It depends what political means.
Well, I think it means Michal is to get him aligned with Saul's family. Abigail, I don't remember. But when he falls for Bathsheba, it's a little bit like David Petraeus falling for what's his name? Bathsheba kind of overwhelms him enough that he has to kill her husband so that he can have her,
he does not kill her husband so he can have her.
He already has.
He kills her husband so that people don't find out that he impregnated her.
Okay.
Which is, well, but that's political.
Fine.
That's political, right? It's different. It's not, he kills her husband so people don't uncover the secret emails. Oh, sorry. We haven't gotten to the Bathsheba story, and there's going to be a lot to say when we get to it. But he sees her, he wants her, he has her. Whether that means that he falls in love with her is a completely different question. Completely different question, right? I don't mean to disabuse anybody of their romantic notions, but it is possible. For, let's not take David as representative of all men, but it's certainly possible for men to want and sleep with someone for whom they don't necessarily have a deep emotional attachment, and especially for a man like David. So I don't know. I just don't know how to answer that question. I accept in as much as Batsheva becomes implicated in a lot of political stuff. But the Petraeus analogy is actually, in some ways, it's not a bad analogy. I mean, apart from like the prurient stuff and the silly stuff and the joking stuff, which is that the illusion that people have that basic human drives are somehow lessened or eliminated or changed by the position that someone's in or the characteristics that they show in other areas of their lives, anybody who reads the Torah would know better. They would just know better. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way with not just men, with human beings. It just doesn't. And when people say, but he was so disciplined, I think, do you know nothing about human nature? As though, yes, well, people in the military are much less inclined to commit adultery than university professors, because they're not disciplined, but people in the military, after all, you know, they can do so many push-ups, so obviously they wouldn't. I mean, it's ridiculous. It makes no sense to think that somebody who's disciplined in one way, when you have, I mean, you don't even have to read the Torah, when you have a long history throughout, or when people would say, how could Clinton have taken such a risk? Well, I mean, that's just, it's not only is it not unprecedented in human history, but human history is full of such examples all over the place. And that's why, one of the reasons I was talking to the UCLA class, and we were talking about all the different ways in which Judaism regulates life. And I said to them, look, there's a reason why there are so many regulations around appetite, eating, and sexuality in particular. And that's because social organizations are very fragile. They're very fragile. And appetite is what explodes carefully arranged social organizations. I mean, that's what does it, you know? You can have somebody who's a pillar of the community and for, you know, 50 years, and then he runs away with a secretary. And so the threat of basic human appetites, precisely because they never go away. It's exactly why they're, so they don't go away if you put on a military uniform, and they don't go away if you become the king, and that's just the reality of life. And I think that part of the reason that the Torah has all these stories in it is to emphasize that the expectation that people are going to be other than people is an unrealistic expectation. So I don't know what I don't know what his attitude was towards Batsheva yet. We'll figure it out when we get there.
Also the fact that he has so much power. All these guys that we hear about, oh my goodness, how can he do that? There's something about being a person in power.
Well, remember what Kissinger said. Mm-hmm. Kissinger, who after all, for all of his virtues, nobody will confuse with George Clooney, right? He said, power is the greatest aphrodisiac. So, and I told you, I remember saying this, I don't remember what the scandal was. The Torah class goes back now a few years, so obviously, but at the time of whatever the previous scandal was, there was, I think it was Gail Collins in the New York Times, but I'm not sure, said that in Washington, as in the rest of the world, the two greatest foci, the two greatest centers of power are old, powerful men and young, pretty women. Different kinds of power. But, so, anyway. All right, anything else on this subject? It'll come up again. It's just whenever the next scandal happens. Yeah. And people will again say, oh my God, I can't believe.
Old, powerful men and young, yeah, attractive women is what the town was built on. That's what the studio system was all about.
Okay. There you go. Huh? He said that's what this town was built on. That's what the studio system was all about. Was old, powerful men and young, attractive women. Yes. Go ahead, change the subject.
David, didn't she even talk about running back to his own family? It's like it's not.
Nope.
They're just out of his.
They're out of his orbit. David's family becomes, yeah. Essentially, he's transcended his family. And also, I would guess, he doesn't run back to his family because that's the first place Saul's going to look for him. I mean, it's the least, probably the least safe place he could go. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
The way I read Jonathan and David is that Jonathan might have been homosexual and David was not.
That's what I did.
It is certainly possible that David was consciously using his charm with Jonathan too, right? I mean, that's, you know.
I don't think it's important.
No, the issue is not important. The only issue is that David, right, what David is capable of doing all through his life, which is quite remarkable, really, and not just with, he does it with Saul, he does it with Jonathan, he does it with Michal, he does it with the Philistine king, is if David wants to get you to like him, he'll get you to like him. If he needs you to do that, he's the person who can walk into the party and everybody loves David. Isn't David a great guy? And that's a tremendous gift for a king to have, after all. Now, as often happens, it doesn't succeed with his own children, which is not uncommon, right? Somebody who's loved by the world, you ask his kids about him and they'll say, you know, right. But it's... you know, I was talking yesterday to Sarah Shulkin, who is our head of school, and she was saying she brought a couple guys from the military who had served for Veterans Day, and they were talking to the eighth graders. And the eighth graders, you know what the eighth graders asked them over and over again? She said it was so interesting to listen to what it was that preoccupied them. They didn't ask them about war. They didn't ask them what it was like to be shot at. They kept asking about the sacrifices they made for their families. Weren't your kids upset that they never saw you? Wasn't it hard for you that you were never home? That's what they were thinking of immediately. That was the sacrifice that they thought about. And so you can imagine that David's kids, you know, were not, as often happens with the children of, I mean, you hear this, for example, with Obama. He doesn't socialize. He spends all this time at home with his kids. And people have mixed feelings about that, right? So it's not an easy thing to pull off, to be a leader and to also have children who get your time, right? So, yeah.
In your book that you're writing,
yes,
are you taking a different approach or tack than these books?
Yes, a little bit, a little bit.
In what way?
I'll tell you when it's done. Yeah.
I had to ask.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Right. Yes, he has to love David. I agree. He has to love David. What that love is can be lots of different kinds of love, but he has to love David. Right? Remember that there are Damon and Pythias, the idea of great male friendship through the course of literature and men sacrificing themselves for other men. That's a big theme. I mean, we just talked about the military. It's a big theme, for example, in the military. Band of Brothers. I mean, it's the same idea. So, yes.
Do we know if Jonathan ever had a wife or kids?
Jonathan does. We don't know about it, and Jonathan is soon to die in battle. Yeah.
No, he ran out of my
Okay, go ahead.
Could it be also Jonathan knows that eventually David will take over his father, and then if
he does know that.
So if he's not smart enough, he doesn't befriend David.
Okay, if you want to see Jonathan as calculating, which is hard to do only because the Bible says a couple times that Jonathan loved David. But if you want to see Jonathan as calculating, you could say Jonathan knows that David is destined to take over the kingship, and he's putting his chips with the winner because he can see how David, you know, so.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. You said maybe if you don't this whole kingdom to put David in place. In other words, this
right. And this is just part of the...
This is just part of getting
right.
David in the right place.
That all of this is an elaborate setup in order to get David as the king of Israel.
Instead of just saying David.
Instead, right. David.
Yeah. We don't know. I mean, eventually we're going to know that David existed. We don't know if Jonathan really existed. And it could be that when the whole story was written, Jonathan is basically an agent of God because his name actually means God gave. So he's like just a plot there helping David be where he wants to, where he needs to be, and then unfortunately dying.
Well, there are certainly, Jonathan can certainly be an agent of David's rise. He is in this not alone. There are many people who contribute to David's rise along the way. Yoav, Abigail, lots of them. And you do get, here's the sense of David's rise could certainly be attributed to David's qualities, as well as to the situation in which he finds himself, or to God's providence, or to both. So, you know, if you read the story at the way the tradition does, at every step of the way, God is making sure that David is protected despite the dangers that surround him. And the truth is, it is a story of triumph over pretty considerable odds. David comes essentially from nowhere, and the king hates him and wants to destroy him, and sends him out on missions that are supposed to get him killed. And despite all of this, he succeeds in being the successful king of Israel. And as I said, most remarkably of all, dies in his bed, which is not the usual fate of kings in the ancient world. But he does. So yes, in that sense, it does feel like David has God's protection. And yet even with that, it's still hard to... It's hard to credit. See, that depends whether you read it with modern or ancient eyes. Because when you read the book with ancient eyes, all these miraculous things that happen that seem so providential, they're due, in fact, to providence. But when you read it with modern eyes, if you drain the story of its of the supernatural manipulations of a god, then you have to see David as being extremely canny, very clever, very gifted, very charismatic, very calculating, and very ambitious. And so you don't have to, by the way, you don't have to take just one and not the other. You can take both, right? You can have God's hand and David's hand in it. But it is, when you read the modern scholarship on David, and he has some of it in that book, in Kirsch's book, although that's a more popular treatment of some of the scholarly stuff, then you get the sense that at least much of the time David knew exactly what he was doing, even if the people around him didn't always know what he was doing, or at least that's the way it's portrayed. So any last question? You got it, Albert. What happened to Samuel? Eventually he dies, and all of Israel mourns him. It says that he dies. No, he's effectively out. Once he ordains Saul, he's effectively out of the power picture, except to de-ordain Saul, which he has done, right? That's his one. He's a kingmaker and a kingbreaker. He's one of the backroom guys, but he can't take over because now the power has shifted from the high priest to the king. So he can't say, okay, this king thing didn't work out. I want to be in control again. So I assume that that's part of, again, if you want to see Samuel as a power broker, that's why he ordains David, because Saul doesn't turn out the way he wants, so he wants to get a new king who will turn out the way he wants, although, as we've seen, I don't think that David could effectively be called anybody's man. So, okay, please rise.